Currently, County Kildare is the fifth highest county in the country for claimants of the pandemic unemployment payment. Joining me now to discuss this is Breed O'Brien, Head of Policy and Media with the Irish National Organisation of the Unemployed. Good afternoon, Breed.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us. I guess the first question I think on the minds of many people here in County Kildare would be that we're quite a busy county, quite a highly populated county ourselves, which may be one of the reasons for this high number. But also, one would assume that there's probably at least 5 or 10 counties in this country that would have a higher number of PUP claimants. But yet, here is Kildare at number 5. Have you any idea what the reason for this is?
Well, basically, it's in keeping with the size of the population. When you look at the population figures for Ireland, Kildare is in and around the county with the fourth or fifth highest population. So it's not out of step with the population when you look at it.
Now, we know that the past year and a half has been very difficult for a lot of people in our community and in our country. Yourselves at the INOU, just what has been the starkest reality that's been noticed by the organisation?
Well, there's just been the ongoing uncertainty. We've had two peaks, one in May of 2020 and one in February of this year, in terms of people on the payment itself. The fact that the state did introduce this payment with less rules and regulations, with greater flexibility, which meant then it was there as a support for a greater number of people. One of the concerns that we would have is for those who maybe aren't fortunate enough to get back their old job or to find a new job, that people who make the transition from the PUP onto the existing job seeker system are going to find the existing system is more rigid, less flexible and less supportive. It's really important that the state really does try to work with people and support people to be able to find a good job.
The 22nd of October, we know that most COVID-19 restrictions will be removed then. Things like nightclubs will be opened and a lot of people are very much looking forward to this. But come the 26th, that is the date that the pandemic unemployment payment does end. And currently people can receive €300 a week, as we know, at the beginning of the pandemic and for most of the time throughout the 18 months, it was €350. The job seekers allowance you're mentioning is €203 a week. That's a huge decrease in the amount of money that's coming into a household by basically €100.
Well, the reality is that at the moment, about half the people on the PUP are in receipt of the €300 and 34% are in receipt of €203. Now, €203 is the maximum amount of money an individual can get on a job seeker's payment. And if somebody does have an entitlement to the social insurance payment job seeker's benefit, then the rate that they receive will depend on the wages they had been receiving when they had been in insurer employment. And if somebody maybe doesn't have an entitlement to JB, doesn't have enough stamps or whatever, they may be applying for the means test of payment. And then not only is their own means taken into account, but if they're a young person living at home, their parents is, or if they're an older unemployed person and they have a partner, their income is taken into account. So people may not receive 203, and it's an experience a lot of people going from job seekers benefit to job seekers allowance go through, where because your family circumstances are taken into account, people find a drop and it can be a much greater than €100. So that's unfortunately the existing system does have a lot of sharp edges and sudden drops in it. And a lot of people go through that experience, unfortunately.
I can imagine yourselves at the INOU are very much interested to see what a budget day next Tuesday brings and how this will affect, I guess, the country as a whole. But here in County Kildare, in regards to the PUP claimants, there's 4,587 people receiving the €300 payment every week. Now, that has decreased by about 200 in the past week. We know that it will continue to decrease as things open back up. But when things do open back up, we know a lot more people will get back to their jobs. But budget-wise, is that also a big factor that yourselves have to take into account? And is it a bit unfortunate or fortunate that it lands a couple of weeks before the end of restrictions?
Well, I think it's important to bear in mind that not everybody in Kildare might be receiving the €300. A good number of them might already be on the 203. And what we would certainly like to see in next week's budget is that the existing system, the system into which eventually the PUP will be folded, that that would become more supportive of people. And we have asked for an increase of €10 because we really feel the existing payment is out of step. And the levels at which they set the PUP for us really demonstrated very clearly how out of step the existing system is. So that is something that we would like to see them address in next week's budget, so that there is an improvement in the existing payments and that they help people to be able to manage to live while they're out of work.
The obvious sector, I think, that's been really the worst hit, I guess, is the accommodation and food services and entertainment sector. Are there any other sectors you think people haven't been concentrating on as much, or have highlighted the plight of those sectors as much, that yourselves at the organisation have noted?
Well, in terms, I suppose, of the sector where the largest numbers have been, has been in the accommodation food, though it has been dropping, and it's been dropping similar to the national figures. You know, it's down very considerably from the two peaks that we saw in February this year and May of last year. There are a number of sectors that seem to be at least 6.5%, if not more, of those in receipt of the pandemic unemployment payment. They have included that sector, wholesale and retail, administrative and support services, and at times construction and manufacturing. So again, as the economy has opened up, the figures have been coming down across all of the sectors. Hopefully, when we get beyond the 22nd of October and the economy finally gets on its feet, hopefully, you know, for more people, their previous employment will be there for them, for those who choose that, or that they will find alternative employment. I suppose another challenge, though, that is facing is that we really don't know. There's been a lot of focus in on the pandemic unemployment payment, but there have been other supports, particularly into businesses, the employment wage subsidy scheme and other supports. The numbers on those have not been dropping to the same effect, and it really is not yet clear when those supports are withdrawn what will happen there. In any normal year, you'd see businesses going in and out of, you know, firms going in and out of business. A lot of that was put on hold over the past year and a half. So again, we could see a lot of job losses all of a sudden, because a lot of firms that might not have survived over the past year and a half, when those supports go, will be gone. So we may not yet have seen the full impact, unfortunately, of COVID-19 on the labour market. We might not see that until next year.
Yeah, yes. This week we're hearing from the central bank that we're going to have a massive bounce back economy-wise, and, you know, things are all well and good. We know that that is not the truth for the huge majority of people. Fuel prices have skyrocketed, electricity bills. You look at food, really the basics, the necessities one needs to live and have some sort of contented lifestyle are the things that have been the hardest hit. And we know that in May in particular of this year, 1 in 4 people out of work as a result of COVID-19 were under the age of 25. We hear about this economy bounce back from the central bank and others this week, but there are a lot of people who are going to be entering the workplace for the first time, maybe after October 22nd this year, for a number of different reasons, but would say it is due to their age and they're just now getting into the working life age. I'm going to assume, and maybe I'm wrong to do so, that they're not going to be the ones that are benefiting from this bounce back economy.
Well, the reality is that the age profile of those in the pandemic unemployment payment has changed. It's gotten older. Young people now account for 1 in 10, those under the age of 25, or 1 in 10. And when you look at the numbers of, you know, the largest age group of those in receipt of the 203 at the moment are people aged 55 plus. And that's an age group that basically has seen a third unemployment crisis. And we know that in our labour market, ageism is an issue, and that getting back into work when you're older can be a real challenge. So there are different challenges facing our employment services. There are young people trying to find maybe their first good job. There are older unemployed people trying to get back into work, some of whom may need support to be reskilled to be able to find a good job. So there's a range of challenges there that we really need to make sure that the services and supports that are on offer to people are the right ones for them, and that will help them get into a good job.
So the age profile, Breed, is those of over the age of 55. We look at the basics there in terms of inflation. As I mentioned, fuel, for example, that skyrocketed, the price of fuel, the price of electricity.
Yeah.
And the majority of those people aged over 55, no matter if they're on the PUP or not, they are going to probably be living in older homes that don't have the same BER ratings, would say, that younger people yep. might have buying their new homes. And then on top of that, younger people can afford, and I don't mean financially when I say this, but they can afford health-wise to eat the cheaper, maybe not as nutritious foods, whereas other foods, as we know, well, food in general, again, the inflation there, food has increased in price. And that is something that older people are more aware of compared to the younger counterparts. So again, just another kind of boulder in the way.
Oh, there are a range of challenges there facing us. Yes, you know, we're in terms of accommodation for younger age cohorts, actually trying to find affordable accommodation, trying to get their maybe own, buy their first home is a real challenge. And even young people in good jobs are struggling with that one. And then for older people, yes, people can be living in older homes that maybe are in need of upgrading. And so then the cost of heating them and keeping them warm is greater. And unfortunately, we seem to be facing into a winter when all of those, the costs of all of that are going to go up. And then there are their ongoing day-to-day costs, like food and all of that, and transport. And, you know, they, you know, kind of to manage and to make ends meet is a real challenge for an awful lot of families. And I think it will be absolutely critical that in next week's budget that the government are seen to be trying to help people to resolve that and to address those challenges that are facing them.
Yeah, Tuesday itself will be a very interesting day, but the days after, it'll be interesting to see if the government does U-turn on anything they have decided in terms of budget 2022, which we do not know of yet, but we can expect an increase to the state pension in particular, I believe, by at least €5. Breed O'Brien, Head of Policy and Media at the Irish National Organisation of the Unemployed, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
And that was, of course, Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble. Now, today is World Sight Day, and I'm joined on the line by June Tinsley. She's Head of Advocacy and Communications at the National Council for the Blind of Ireland. June, you're welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having me on.
Delighted to do so. I suppose it's a great occasion where one needed to be able to debunk even some of the myths, some of the stereotypes around blindness or vision impairment. Around 55,000 people in Ireland or thereabouts live with some form of visual impairment.
That's correct. And that figure of 55,000 is probably an underrepresentation because it's a census 2016 figure. So it's quite out of date. But I suppose what NCBI is doing is just basically seizing the opportunity to mark World Sight Day as a chance to educate and share and engage the public to essentially debunk some myths or misperceptions individuals might have about what it's like to be blind or vision impaired. And it's very simple things. It's like realising that because there's such a variety of eye diseases that subsequently there's different variations of vision impairment and blindness. Not everybody would use a Vicane, for example. Some would use a guide dog, some wouldn't. And others just rely on their remaining vision. So there's such variation that what we would definitely want to highlight is that a one size doesn't fit all.
And that concept of remaining vision, June, is something that people in society in general often forget. There are some conditions where you may lose your peripheral vision. There are some conditions where you may lose central vision, or you may lose your acuity of vision.
Correct. I suppose it really just depends on the eye condition that you have. And NCBI would certainly work with individuals to encourage them to maximise that residual vision. And teach them skills and techniques and strategies that they can use on in everyday life to make sure that they can maximise their own independence and live life confidently.
And in terms then of independence, that includes agency in how you engage with society and how society engages with you, and that's where language is key.
Correct, and I suppose one of the other messages is to encourage the general public and everybody, regardless of your different walks of life, just to use ordinary language and not to make the situation feel more awkward. Feel free to use words like look, see, watch, all those kind of everyday language. However, if you are giving somebody who's blind or vision impaired indirect directions, make sure you give the verbal instruction as well, as opposed to just pointing them down the road.
An awful lot of us have that terrible habit. It's just go on down the road there and go over that way, and you'll be gesturing to the right or to the left or what have you, and just not registering that you're not stating the directions. You're just waving.
Correct. Yes. So I suppose offering verbal instruction is what's required, and it's a very simple thing that people can do all the time. But it's just important to remind people to be that literal and give that verbal instruction as opposed to just pointing down the road. And likewise, to offer verbal assistance, if you're offering to help somebody cross the road, never just grab an individual because, as you said earlier, if a person has lost their peripheral vision, they won't see that person to their side.
You get such a fright then.
Exactly. They just get startled, as you would expect. So always just kind of say, I'm here beside you. Would you like me to guide you across the road? And just, as I keep saying, use verbal assistance.
There's also, I suppose, the onus on people who do not live with any kind of sight loss or visual impairment to gracefully accept a declination of assistance. People may not always need help.
Correct. And as I've mentioned there, individuals who are blind or vision impaired lead very full lives, doing everything that everybody else does, and have learned the skills to get around safely. Some, as I said, use canes, some use guide dogs, others use their remaining vision. So they may not need that assistance. And thank you for offering, but sometimes it might be unwarranted.
Another thing, actually, Anna, I was actually just reading some of your literature. There is this, it's a really old wives' tale, but the people who may not have their full visual power available to them have some kind of other extrasensory powers, like they're X-Men. And whilst I imagine that would be great, it's also not true.
True, yes, definitely. As you rightly say, people who are blind or vision impaired will rely more on their other senses, particularly listening out for audio cues. But it's certainly not at a heightened level than anybody else in the population. Another thing that people who are blind to vision impaired do is develop a very strong memory skills. So if you can imagine, if they're out and about in their own local community and able to navigate safely, but when that environment changes because of either outdoor furniture dining or more pedestrianised streets, those kind of things, It can certainly knock an individual's confidence because the memory they had of that area has now changed. And we were trying to encourage business owners to make sure that they cordoned off those outdoor spaces so that it was going to be safe for an individual to pass by.
Well, June Tinsley, Head of Advocacy and Communication at the National Council for the Blind of Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. 2/3 of the garments that we wear comprise fibres used, made from a synthetic material sourced from crude oil, if you don't mind. And to discuss this and indeed what we're wearing in general, I'm joined on the line by editor of Irish Country Living, Amy McKeever. Amy, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi. Thanks, Ciara.
That is a huge proportion of the clothing that we wear, sourced effectively from one source, which is finite, and of which the prices have shot up in recent weeks.
I think that a lot of people will not be aware that a lot of the clothes that we wear is actually coming from the oil industry. A huge amount of everything that we use in our daily lives is coming from the oil industry. And with climate change being such a big issue, it's something that we all need to be aware of. Our consumption in the last 20 years, like the amount of fabrics being produced has doubled over the last 20 years. And that is set to continue to increase up to 2030. There was a slight knock to it during COVID, but it's marginal and it's set to continue to increase. And a lot of that is fast fashion. And the big problem with the fast fashion is it's nearly seen as disposable, because somebody who pays a very small amount of money for something doesn't place as much value on it.
They'll wear it once, it'll go into the back of their wardrobe and from there to the charity shop or into the bin, never to see the light of day again.
Unfortunately, it's not going to the charity shop. It's going to landfill. We are not recycling clothes to that extent. And a lot of the clothes as well that go to charity shops, unfortunately, don't end up getting reworn by other consumers. They end up going to African countries, and that's a completely different problem. When I spoke to the Department of Environment about this, they did mention that as well, that they're acutely conscious of our waste ending up as somebody else's problem. Mm. But with the fast fashion industry, there has been, and you know, there has been a rise in the number of products that people buy. And it's been attributed, I suppose, to younger people having an interest. And, you know, it's a diversity as well. People like to show their own character through their clothes. But unfortunately, then, these clothes mightn't be all that well made. They're very cheap, and therefore they're seen as disposable. Like, the EU citizens consume nearly 26 kilograms of textile every year, and 42% of that is discarded. Scary.
And it absolutely is. And there, any of us that has looked at the label of a garment that we own, and I think we all have at some point or another, will be familiar with polyester, nylon, acrylic, elastane, possibly not as familiar with polypropylene. But polyester,
polyester is the big one. And everything, nearly, polyester is the really big one. It's the synthetic fibre that most clothes are made out of. Plant fibres, cottons, flax, those kind of things, they make up about 30%. You know, your cellulosic fibres, they're a bit of a problem in terms of, it's made from plants, from trees. And then your animal fibres, wool, leather, tiny proportion. So, you know, you might think, oh, a lot of my clothes are coming from the plant or animal industry, but they're actually not. It is that they make up a tiny percentage, particularly the animal fibres. Now, they're disappearing fast.
Or if you're looking for wool, if you buy a jumper down the road and, you know, it says Irish wool on it, in all probability, that's imported merino, not grown on an Irish sheep at all. So you're not even cutting down on the carbon footprint of the garment you're buying.
It's very disappointing. We did a lot of stories over in the West over the course of the summer, you know, holidaying at home, and I was constantly looking out for an Irish Aran jumper, and I didn't find one, unfortunately. We did. There is some cheap breeders over in the West that are producing wool, and we hope there's going to be a slight change in that. But the percentage you're talking about is so tiny. Like, it's approximately 1%. Of the animal fibres is wool now. Like, it is the biggest wool. You have alpaca and you have, you know, cashmere and other kind of wools like that. But the sheep's wool is predominantly the big one. And there's reasons for that as well. Like, merino is a very versatile product. You know what I mean? You probably remember, I certainly do, having a wool jumper when I was a kid.
And
the life out of you.
Yeah.
So there is work to be done on that as well. The Department of Environment are looking, as part of the Waste Action Plan for a Circular Economy, that they assured me was that they were setting up a group. The EPA was currently looking into this waste issue, and they were looking at ways to improve our circularity. And I presume that's going to be, you know, to do with secondhand shops and to do with, you know, kind of encouraging people to make use of their clothes. I do have a second part of this coming next week, just about recycling. And I spoke to a lady who's studying sustainable fashion in the United States. She got a scholarship from the EPA to go to study this. And she was saying, like, I asked her, what should we be doing then? You know what I mean? If you're going to a wedding and you want to look your best, you know, what do you do? And she said, rent. You know, it's particularly for formal events. Rent an outfit, because for a formal event, you're not going to wear it again. So rent, buy in secondhand stores, go back to the hand-me-downs for kids' clothes are so cheap now, and everybody... Yeah. But we don't pass on clothes. I still get from my children's cousins now, I get the black bag, and I'm always very grateful to see it coming. There is a tendency that, you know, you're in pennies and you see a couple of nice little T-shirts for €2 each.
They're half nothing. I'll have five of them, and then you think no more about it.
And I suppose, you know, I have to be personal about this. Well, I'd be one of the worst for it. When I think about this myself, the amount of clothes I have in the wardrobe, how often do I wear them? And Miriam, who I spoke with, lady in America, she said she went without buying anything new for a full year. Now, she's a seamstress herself and she can tailor. But it's something, I suppose, it's a skill set, and maybe it's time that we've lost over time, that, you know, kind of, okay, how can I tailor that? Or how can I get that altered to make it something new? But, you know, there's enough, her attitude is there's enough fibres on the planet at the moment that we just need to recycle them. But with the recycling, most clothes, when you look at the label and you see that, you know, eco-conscious or something like that label on it, those fibres, we actually can't recycle fibre. We can't recycle polyester. So a polyester dress that gets recycled doesn't turn into another polyester dress. A polyester dress you buy and it says it's recycled, that's actually plastic bottles. No, and that keeps them out of the water. Yeah. That's brilliant. But there's actually a huge demand now for recycled plastic bottles because brands want to be seen to be moving in the right direction in relation to this. So I suppose, and we talk about food a lot, and you know, this is why I write these articles as well, because there's so much information out there and it's hard to know what the kernel of truth is, I suppose. And just with like climate change, I suppose, you know, I mean, food gets a mean rap, but you do have to eat. And we're great producers of food. We don't produce any clothes in this country. We don't produce any fibres as such. Mm. And yet we buy clothes that, which we don't need, which contribute to climate change. So I suppose what I'd be kind of thinking is, if we're going to be consuming, let's consume nutrients that we need as opposed to clothes that we don't.
Well, Amy McKeever, editor at Irish Country Living, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, I should have on air Alan Farrell, TD. Alan, are you there? Hello? There's somebody there on the line, but there he is now. Alan, can you hear me?
I can, Ciara. Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for joining me. Alan, you witnessed what can only be described as an absolutely horrific incident on the Dart in the vicinity of Malahide on Wednesday. It has been roundly condemned. Take us through what you saw.
Well, thanks for having me on, Ciara. I was on the last Dart to Malahide, so northbound train from Dublin City Centre on Wednesday evening. A group of lads and girls in the sort of 20 age bracket boarded. They were very rowdy, and during the course of the journey, a young woman exited the train, and chants of "Let's rape her" or "rape her" were shouted after she left the train, I should point out. Mm. It was an appalling and horrifying incident. I actually had my headphones in at the time, although nothing was on, and I had to turn to a fellow passenger and ask, had I misheard? It was verified that, in fact, they did say what was reported, which it really is horrible, vile, threatening behaviour that I've never experienced in all my years of using public transport.
I would imagine there was, even though very thankfully nothing happened to that woman or to anybody else in the carriage, there must have been a palpable sense of fear and horror in that carriage.
Well, there certainly was. There were two young boys, I'd say there were teenage boys sitting next to me opposite the other side of the carriage. And when I turned to them, they I'd be quite honest, they looked taken aback by it, and there was a young woman sitting adjacent to me who spent the rest of the journey staring at the floor, and it really troubled me. Although there was no immediate physical threat, the sentiment expressed was so shocking to me that I spent the remainder of the journey sitting on the edge of my seat, making sure that nothing transpired. It should be pointed out here, it wasn't a small group. There was, you know, 10 or 11 of them. With a couple of girls, and then there were other people on the opposite end of the carriage. It was actually quite busy for that hour. But yes, there was certainly, I spent the rest of the journey sort of listening carefully to what was being said, you know, lest anything happened or that their words turned into action. I didn't believe that it would, but it should be said, it was a horrifying experience for anybody, and really any woman who was on that train, I'm sure, was very fearful for their safety.
And arguably, certainly, in theory, rightfully so, because to be in an enclosed space where a group of 10 or 11 people have made the act of unconscious decision, and I understand that people behave differently in a group than they will on an individual basis. I'm very cognizant of that. But they all collectively arrived at the decision to start yelling, "Let's rape her."
Yeah, there was at least two at it, if not more. You can understand it's not the quietest of environments. It's a very loud train. All of the windows were open. We were underway, so the wind was blowing through the windows and all the rest of it. So it wasn't a quiet environment. So I wouldn't be able to say with certainty whether it was five or six of them, but there were certainly two or more. They were loud. They were sufficiently loud for me to hear them, and I was, you know, perhaps 10 metres away. And it was one of those displays of misogyny that, you know, you might read about, but you'd never witness it yourself. And as I said, unfortunately for the passengers on the train at the time, we witnessed it. I must say, Ciara, I was heartened by the speed at which Irish Rail responded to me. They did so at 7:30 on Thursday morning. Yeah. And I am aware from speaking to Gardaí that there is an investigation underway and that the CCTV is being reviewed. I haven't had an update on that today, but I'm assuming at this stage they probably have the footage.
Alan, what was the behaviour of that particular group like after that chant?
They were rowdy when they got on the train and they were rowdy when they got off the train, and they didn't cease in between. Half of them were wearing masks, which was what originally bothered me, if I'm quite honest.
Yeah.
But obviously what transpired thereafter was 10 times more concerning. It's something that, you know, I know there's been calls for, you know, transport police in the past and presently. And what I would say to that in terms of the concern is, you know, you can't have a security person on every carriage. You can't have a Garda on every street corner. But, you know, we in society have a huge role to play in ensuring that we influence young people, and particularly in that age bracket, to mind their language, to be careful around other people, particularly vulnerable people on their own, and women in particular. I mean, it's a horrifying incident in the context of just normal societal behaviour. But unfortunately, it is growing. That sort of behaviour is growing. And we have seen it undoubtedly in video footage online and things like that. It occurred at the start of the summer in my own community, where we had antisocial behaviour sort of unprompted and just in your face, that I think most people in society are just not used to. But, you know, we have a responsibility, and certainly the government, the Gardaí and the courts have a role to play, but I do think it's more important that parents and peers can influence young men, and in particular, you know, have a conversation and hope.
If you could just move around a small bit, Alan, your line is breaking up, and it's very important that we hear everything you have to say.
Not at all.
This absolutely vile incident. I note that some of the commentary online, I think unfairly, berates you and indeed anybody else who is in the carriage for not intervening. And that might perhaps underscore other people's calls for the introduction of a transport police. But it seemed like it was an innately volatile situation, that it was you could really have gone anyway, and it's wonderful and something to be grateful for that nothing happened thereafter.
I agree with you, and I can assure your listeners that if I believe that a woman was being subjected to that in person, i.e. she was sitting or standing doors, that I absolutely would have intervened. But the cult only came out after death. She was gone. I'm not even convinced you heard it. The general rule, and honestly, it has occurred.
Unfortunately, I think we're going to have to conclude that interview prematurely. Alan's line is breaking down, but I think he's made the vast majority of his points, made them very well. It's a beyond a shocking turn of events that this kind of chant, this "let's rape her," could be thrown at a woman on public transport or anywhere else in society for any reason at all whatsoever. And I know some people would have been listening, hearing Alan's description of that particular group in their early 20s and rowdy, a mixed gender group, saying, oh, look, they're young, they're probably in high spirits, they've, you know, had something to drink. It's no excuse. There are no mitigating factors or mitigating elements in that kind of vile, vile misogyny. Now, feed a cold, starve a fever, feed a cold. Who knows what one it's supposed to be, but I think an awful lot of us use it as a little bit of self-care when you're feeling under the weather. But to discuss whether either of them work at all, joined on the line by registered dietitian Maria Lucy. Maria, you're very welcome to the programme.
Great. Thank you, Ciara. I'm delighted to be here.
Delighted to have you. I'm going to go out on a limb and say probably neither feeding or starving a cold, feeding or starving a fever have any real impact at all.
Yeah, you'll be right there. I think it's a common old wives' tale at this point. Really, when you're sick, when you're any bit under the weather, whether it's the common cold or a flu, your body is trying to fight off an infection. So at this time, it actually needs more food, probably. It needs, the last thing you want to be doing is trying to starve us. It needs energy.
Now, by more food, we do not mean a banquet.
No, definitely not. But I think when you're under the weather, that's probably the time when your appetite is going to drop. And it's where you might have to make a little bit more of a conscious effort to make sure that you're still having regular meals and snacks if you can, because that will help your body kind of get back to its best ability again.
So if you're feeling under the weather and it isn't particularly serious, it is just the common cold, it is our common or garden flu and not one of those flus I think we all get about once or twice in our lives where your bones hurt. What should we be eating? What should we be avoiding?
Yeah, I suppose there's no magic cure if you have a cold. There is some evidence out there about vitamin C that it might help with the duration of the cold, but really the evidence isn't massively strong. So if somebody wants to take, I know it is quite a popular thing that somebody will take a vitamin C supplement when they do have that cold, they can, but I just would always say not to be taking it long term. The best thing is to be making sure you're meeting your vitamin needs all year round if you can. When you have a cold, when you are under the weather, I think what feels good to you at that time. So for a lot of people, it could be something like warm soups and trying to make sure that they have nutrition in them, that they're not just kind of watery broths as such. It could be maybe a chicken soup. I know that's another common old wives' tale.
But it's easy to eat and it is nutritious. So it would make sense that is something that we would go for.
Yeah, exactly. And when you break it down, it is actually a very nourishing thing to be eating, and you'll be getting in your fluid as well, which is important if you have a fever because you need that little bit of extra fluid. So I think if that feels good to you at that time, that's a really good way to get in nutrition. But try to make sure you're adding things into that soup, that there is vegetables, that there is a protein like a chicken or a bean or something in that as well.
Now, there's a magic medicine that has been used up and down the land of Ireland for many, many years, and it helped many small children in particular be able to go back to school, and that's Flat 7-Up. Does that do anything at all, or are we just looking at the extra boost from the sugar here and the hydrating effects?
Yeah, it probably is kind of that hydration and that sugar. It's nothing too magical, really. But if that works, for you, but there is no magic cure with the Flat 7-Up. I know myself, that's something my mother would have given us as a child as well.
But there's a panacea effect with something like that. If you have, I suppose, health and wellness traditions in your family, particularly when you're small, you're a little bit babied, the Flat 7-Up or whatever it is in your house comes out, you automatically feel a little bit better. So I imagine we carry those food traditions and cultures into our adult lives, and then, you know, myths are born.
Yeah, and there's nothing really wrong with it. It's normal enough for us to have associations with food that they are comforting. You know, if something goes wrong and you go home to your mother and she has a lovely warm stew for you, you're naturally going to feel better. And it's good that food can comfort us in some regards. I think food has a bad name in terms of comforting us when we take it too far and we're using it to soothe our emotions all the time, in particular if it's foods that are very high in fat and sugar that we don't necessarily need to be eating too much of.
So the key thing on a day-to-day basis, but particularly when you're not feeling you're not feeling at the top of your health game, is just to eat a well-rounded, balanced diet, but ensure particularly that when you're feeling a little under the weather, that you prioritise nutrition. Like, you're not going to go and order a massive takeaway to make yourself feel better.
Yeah, it's really, I suppose, I would always try to still have your breakfast, your lunch and your dinner if you can, to try and make that conscious effort. For some people, when they do, if you have kind of nausea, it can be better to have cold foods or plainer foods, like even something like crackers with cheese might be an option, or kind of going for the plainer foods at that time, but still trying to make that conscious effort to try and at least have your three meals a day.
Well, registered dietitian Maria Lucy, thank you indeed for joining us.